From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, an immigration attorney weighs in on the current challenge to birthright citizenship. Then we'll examine the importance of civics education.
Not knowing the history of the country, why the country was founded in the first place, it makes it very difficult when you don't know that. Then how are you going to move forward and how are you going to make it a better place for all of us right now?
Plus, our latest Live at Lake Effect features Craig Finn, lead singer of The Hold Steady, sharing his solo work.
I think that Minneapolis scene, both the music and sort of the ideals of doing things honestly and doing things yourself, have been something I've tried to bring with me.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with a new check-in. That's an ongoing series from WUWM where we look at the rapidly changing immigration landscape in the U.S. Today, we're looking into birthright citizenship, as multiple federal courts have now ruled against President Donald Trump's executive order seeking to end it in the U.S. Earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments about the power of those rulings. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez asked Milwaukee-based immigration attorney Mark Christopher about the history of the 14th Amendment and birthright citizenship.
We're talking about birthright citizenship, which has been constitutional law for over a century now. But to start kind of at the beginning of all this, where does the amendment even come from?
The 14th Amendment was enacted shortly after the Civil War. And the reason they enacted it is because some of the southern states were still not providing basic services or recognizing some of the freed slaves as citizens. So they passed the 14th Amendment, which has a number of provisions. Of them is something called birthright citizenship. In other words, if you are born, and it says quite clearly, if you are born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States. And again, that was put into place because southern states were attempting to not recognize the freed slaves as citizens for purposes of voting, for purposes of government services, and for other basic rights.
Mm. And then when do we see that amendment or that language challenged?
So what happened is shortly after taking office, President Trump issued an executive order, which said that if your parents were not citizens of the United States, then you, as the child, would then not be a U.S. citizen just by the fact that you were born in the United States.
You know, you're getting to how simplistic the language is. Mm-hmm. It says 14th Amendment, Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the U.S. and the states wherein they reside. So, thinking of that language being pretty clear, what's being challenged, or maybe even better yet, who exactly is being challenged within that executive order?
Yeah, so the executive order for individuals who are in the United States who do not have citizenship or maybe are here without legal status. And the provision within the 14th Amendment or within that clause that you just read is the clause that says, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So I think they're trying to make some type of argument that the individuals who are here maybe without legal status or without citizenship are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. But anybody who has read any of the precedent decisions on this 14th Amendment provision and is just familiar with basic jurisprudence or law under the United States knows that whether or not you're here with legal status or you're here on it as a visitor, you're still subject to the jurisdiction and the laws of the United States. So I'm not exactly sure how they're going to get around that.
All right, let's talk about the oral arguments that were heard, because I think there was some confusion, myself included, as far as what they're actually hearing. Is it arguments for this executive order, or is it arguments against kind of these rulings from the federal court? So can you break down exactly what happened last week and what the Supreme Court was actually hearing?
Yeah, the executive order for the birthright citizenship was a vehicle to take up to the Supreme Court on a different issue. And what happened in this case is that a district judge in California enjoined the executive order from going forward. And with that injunction, it's applied to the entire United States. So the issue before the Supreme Court wasn't the constitutionality of the executive order. It was whether or not a single district court can issue a nationwide injunction on an executive order. So that's the issue, whether or not a single district court, their injunction can be made to impact the entire United States.
Mm. What did the federal court say when this executive order first came in front of them?
Yeah. So on the issue of birthright citizenship, there have been three major Supreme Court decisions which have clearly stated that if you're born in the United States, that you are a citizen, regardless of your lineage, your parent status, that type of thing. A separate issue is what's been tradition in the United States is that when the president issues an executive order, it can be challenged in the federal courts. And if a court decides that this is likely going to infringe on some basic rights or that it would likely be found unconstitutional, that court can issue an injunction. In other words, stopping that executive order from taking effect until it makes its way on the merits through the court system. And when there was a lawsuit that was filed, the court indicated that this would seem to be very clearly a violation of the 14th Amendment. And as a result of that, they said they were going to issue a nationwide injunction that foreclosed this executive order from taking effect until it ran its course on the merits. In other words, until that issue could be litigated in the federal courts.
So this hearing happens. The justices have their time to speak. What about that kind of back and forth caught your ear as far as what people can expect going forward?
Yeah, and this was kind of interesting. I was really struck by the questioning from Justice Kavanaugh, and he was asking the Solicitor General. He said, okay, if this were to go into effect, how do you expect the states, the local governments, and everyone else to comply so quickly with such an executive order? This would be a major shift in policy in the United States that's going to affect every level and unit of government. And the Solicitor General indicated basically that it was up to each agency, each state, each local jurisdiction to come into compliance with the executive order. And the other thing that struck me is that the justices asked the Solicitor General, there are so many people that this is going to affect, so many parents that this is going to affect. Why is it not smarter to have a nationwide injunction, let the constitutionality of the issue be decided? And the Solicitor General said that it would be better if each person were to file a lawsuit in each of their jurisdictions and have injunctions, if the courts deem them to be appropriate, district by district, which seems almost absurd when you think about a parent is giving birth to a child. And there's every parent is supposed to hire an attorney and file a federal lawsuit seeking to enjoin or challenge an executive order. But that's what the Solicitor General seem to suggest.
What are the potential consequences that you could see for the people that you represent or the people that may find themselves in a vulnerable position from a ruling like this?
Well, the people that I represent, I mean, if their children are not deemed to be U.S. citizens, those children will not necessarily be able to get some of the basic rights, protections, and benefits of living in the United States, whether that be potentially from schooling, whether that be from healthcare, whether that be them being able to assert legal rights in courts. But I think that there's a broader concern in the sense that to what degree are we going to look back and potentially strip people of their citizenship? If a birth certificate in the United States in and of itself is no longer proof of your U.S. citizenship, what do we have to prove that we're U.S. citizens? Do we then have to show our parents' birth certificates? Do we have to show our parents' naturalization certificates? Do we have to show our grandparents' naturalization certificates? It creates a tangled web for just an average person to demonstrate that they're a United States citizen.
I'm also curious, thinking about just people affected, what are the concerns you're hearing from either clients or peers about this order?
Well, obviously, people who have had children in the United States recently are concerned that their children are not going to be recognized as citizens. And with it are some basic protections and responsibilities. They are concerned about that. But here's the other issue. I have had other clients contact me whose parents maybe were not U.S. citizens at the time they were born. They're worried that it's going to impact them or if this executive order, which was enacted in January of 2025, maybe could be expanded and then work retroactively so it would impact them. So they are scared. And they're asking, what do I need to get from my parents to prove that I'm a U.S. citizen? I have not had clients like this, but I have heard from other attorneys, the individuals who were seeking to have labor induced, so they have their children before, or their child before the executive order takes effect. So that's the level of anxiety that's out there as a result of this executive order.
Hmm. And thinking about moving forward, where do we go from here? The Supreme Court just had these hearings listening to the legality of these injunctions, but what happens next? What can people expect?
Yeah, so it depends on how the Supreme Court rules on this. If the Supreme Court says, yes, nationwide injunctions on executive orders are unconstitutional, then the executive order may be enforceable in certain districts where the district courts have not enjoined. So in other words, to make it more simple, there might be certain areas in the United States whereby this executive order will become law, at least until the Supreme Court hears the issue, which can be years down the road.
I guess we'll just keep our eyes peeled. Mark, thank you so much for helping us try to make sense of such a complicated issue.
I hope I did. Thank you very much.
Mark Christopher is an immigration attorney. He spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez about birthright citizenship for our series, The Check-In, Voices from Milwaukee's Changing Immigration Landscape. This reporting is part of WUWM's commitment to report on the issues our community has told us are most important. We're devoting more coverage to three topics: climate change, immigration, and the economy. You can find more of our immigration coverage at WUWM.com. A study from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation found that 70% of Americans would fail a basic civics test. As constitutional rights are being questioned, a lack of civic engagement and understanding can lead to distrust in our government. Marquette University's Lubar Center Director Derek Mosley joins me now to share how civics goes beyond knowing our three branches of government. Let's establish a basic definition of civics when we're talking about this subject. So what is it and what does it revolve around?
Yeah, so civics encompasses a whole bunch of different subjects. So it encompasses everything from history, social studies, a little poli-sci, basically letting people know how their government works, why it works, what are their rights, what are their responsibilities, which is almost as important as their rights, so that one day they will become better citizens and then hopefully from that knowledge, seek to change the world in places where they think they could have an effect. So that's the basic definition when we talk about civics.
I really like that. It definitely goes beyond legislative, judicial, and executive branches, yeah. Right? So,
And they're all in there, right?
For
that's
sure.
The little poli-sci part we talk about, but you know, it's history. Part of that study said that they asked people a simple question like, you know, who do we fight in World War II? And they were like shocked that no one knew. And another one was like they had a multiple choice question of name one thing Benjamin Franklin did. And one of the answers was invented the light bulb, right? Which is obviously wrong, but a lot of people picked it. And so it's things like that. Not knowing the history of the country, why the country was founded in the first place. It makes it very difficult when you don't know that. Then how are you going to move forward and how are you going to make it a better place for all of us right now?
Exactly. And in general, in America, civics are taught from kindergarten through high school, but then is most likely an elective, maybe one basic course if you choose to not study it further in college. And you being at Marquette Law School, I'm sure you're surrounded by staff and students who perhaps have a better than average understanding of civics. But what are some contributing factors you believe are factors in the decline in civic education and general knowledge?
You know, I just thought about this question recently, and I wonder if a lot of it has to do with the fact that it seems like, Audrey, that we are in a continuous political cycle, right? No matter what, we're always talking about politics. Some election's coming up in the next couple of months, all the time. And maybe it's just the fact that people are just tired of hearing about elections all the time, right? We know it's definitely a lack of teachers, lack of teachers who are teaching this subject. It's a very specialized subject. And also, it's a lot had to do with the government itself. You know, we kind of shifted our focus, worried about the fact that we are being out-educated by China, and went to like science and math being more important than learning more about who our country was and how we were founded. And so I think it's like a this perfect storm of things that happened that made it not a number one priority anymore.
Yeah, and on the note of teachers, as we continue to learn and grow as people, as educators, systems, you know, we are ideally embracing the fact that not all accounts of history are quote-unquote correct. There's more than one view. There's more than one perspective. And I think that's been a big challenge in promoting civics education, because we have to address that, right, in the way that it was classically taught.
Yeah, and you know what? That's good. And it's bad, right? So, for instance, you know that I'm a student of Black history. And when you talk about there's more than one version of history, that didn't used to be the case. There used to be this one version of history that was in the book that everybody read, no matter if you went to school in Wisconsin or you went to school in LA, we had the same history book and we learned from this same civics book, right? But things have changed. And I know as a student of Black history, I've noticed that there's all these stories that have been left out. You know, a lot of stories of people who didn't look like me or didn't tell the native perspective. And so now that we know that there's other stories out there, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's become this not one version of history exists anymore. And what you prioritize as being the most important version of that history seems to be different depending on who you talk to.
And when it comes to understanding our government, right, there's the big G government, there's the national, federal level, there's people who get involved on the local level. But this is also reflected, I feel, in our elections and our election turnouts, right? Maybe our lack of knowledge and understanding also correlates with maybe people not showing up to the polls as much or knowing the importance of their comptroller or other things like this. So do you think there are some common misconceptions about how our government works when it comes to civics and understanding as well?
Absolutely. And I don't think that is only limited to the citizenry. I used to be an elected official and I used to be a part of one of those branches of government, right? The judicial branch. And I was surprised in my everyday work as someone who was a part of the judiciary that the other branches of government were not aware that we were a separate branch of government, right? That we weren't a department head. You know, I wasn't like Department of Public Works chairman. I didn't work for them. I was a separate elected official who represented a separate but equal branch of government. And so I don't want it to seem like it's the citizenry who don't know what's going on. Ultimately, it's all of us who don't understand the basic principles of how our government works and why we have it, why it's so important that we have these three branches of separate but equal governments to keep a check on each other, to make sure that everybody's playing by the same set of rules.
And I also think the general idea that, you know, no branches of government should be running by themselves. They all have different checks and balances on one another. But at the same time, these checks and balances aren't a self-propelled machine, right? I mean, can you share your experiences working in one yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And elections have everything to do with that, right? So you can have your separate branches of government that have their own checks and balances on each other. But we're a political system. Right. Where we have a right now just a two party system. And depending on what party you belong to and what party's in power, that generally controls how things are viewed. So if one party has all the branches of government, right, has the executive, the judicial and the legislative branch, well, that agenda seems to be the agenda that takes hold. Right. No matter how the other side might feel about it, that agenda takes hold because those checks and balances are all being done by the people who subscribe to the same party. And so I don't know if it's ever been as polarized as it is now. Perhaps it has been. I'm quite sure in the founding of the country it was pretty polarized. But at this moment, right now, modern history, this is pretty polarizing. And our politics have become so inflamed that it's all about getting your agenda done and not so much about taking care of everybody, not just the people who fall in your party, everybody. And that's why civics is so important. It's more than just a history book. It's more than just a political science class. It's more than all of these things. It's a combination of all these things to understand who we are, why we are, and what can we do to make this place better for all of us.
On that note, I want to address some more of the consequences of a lack of civic education for people of all ages, right? But I think one of the most pressing ones, and what you were just talking about, is that a lack of understanding also corresponds with a decline in trust in our government, which is especially evident when things are hyperpolarized.
Yeah, you know, when you live in this hyperpolarized society where it's more important about getting these wins than it really is about actually legislating, then you see things that happen like not a lot happening in the legislative cycle, right? Or the will of the people you see in these studies. The study says that, I mean, we do polls all the time at Marquette Law School, and our polls say this percentage of people agree with this thing. But then it gets to the legislature, and that's not the agenda of the legislature. Despite the fact that the vast majority of people feel that way, it doesn't happen. And so when that happens, people get really upset and feel like they're not really part of this system. The system belongs to a group of people who get elected, and they're not part of those people. And so they check out. And then when they check out, it leads to problems in our system, from the local school board all the way up to, you know, president of the United States. So it's all together how this works. And it's all being held together by this concept that we call civics.
And if we don't have a good baseline understanding, right, of these civics, do you think this also impacts our ability to have productive conversations with people we may disagree with?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're already in this society now that we don't talk to people who are different from us anyway, right, who don't think the same way we do. So just to give you an example, I used to love to watch on the late night talk shows, right? And they would like go on the streets and they would just put a microphone to someone and say, who's the president of the United States? You know, things like that, right? And you're like, how do they find these people who don't know who the president is and all these things? But when you realize it, people have checked out. They have completely checked out. And so I look at that and I say, how can this possibly happen? But if you feel like the system isn't working for you, or people aren't fighting for you or what you believe in, you check out. And what we think is unbelievable, 70% of Americans couldn't pass the basic civics test. It actually starts to make sense. When people check out, they don't pay attention. They don't have conversations with people who think differently than them. And they're in these little echo chambers that they talk to all the time. And they never confront different points of view, different issues. And you know, isn't that what school is all about? Isn't that what the education system is all about, is to get into a room of people who don't think like you and to actually talk about issues from a different points of view and learning different points of view? But we've become so polarized that no matter what we talk about, everything's so political. And it could be basic, but somehow it becomes political. And so I never thought in a million years that school board elections would be so political. You know, I thought we were all in the same boat here. We want our kids to learn and, you know, and do well in school. But that's what's happened. And we don't talk. And when we do talk, we don't talk to people who think differently than we do.
Absolutely. Well, the work is just beginning. It's far from over. But Derek, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to have this important conversation.
Audrey, thank you for letting me come on and talk about this important conversation.
Derek Mosley is the director of Marquette University's Lubar Center. We spoke earlier this year. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. We'll head to the Lake Effect Surf Shop for a new episode of Live at Lake Effect in about 10 minutes. But first, we'll share some recommendations for Wisconsin state parks to add to your summer adventures. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. From the Driftless region to the Northwoods to the Door County Peninsula, the Wisconsin State Park System encompasses 50 parks. The DNR manages 1.2 million acres of recreation areas as a part of the system, including state forests, state trails, and over 6,000 campsites. With so much to explore, where do you even start? Well, for recommendations, freelance writer Allie Waters has plenty of suggestions to help you start planning. So there are 50 Wisconsin state parks. So how many have you personally traveled to so far, and how did you get into the outdoors and all the activities that this can encompass?
I have always had a love for the state parks. And as a child, my family, we all used to kind of pile into our minivans and we would go to different destinations around Wisconsin. And some of the ones that I really have a fond memory for are going to like Devil's Lake State Park. And we went to the Elroy Sparta Trail. We went to the Peninsula State Park. And that was kind of my first introduction to it, was doing these family camping trips, hiking around the town, playing with my cousins. I have now been to 20 state parks, and I would love to get to them all over the course of my lifetime, but it's hard because I keep returning to so many of my favorites, but I try to squeeze in a few new ones each year.
Well, I totally understand going back to the favorites, and your core memories are right along the line with my family camping trips. So whether people are exploring new parks or going back to old favorites, there truly is something for everyone, including those looking for different kinds of geography. So can you explain a bit of like the variety that people have access to within our state?
Yeah, so I broke this up in all sorts of different ways. We have the ones that are close to home. We have a section called The Bluffs Are Calling, which is all about our rocky geological state parks that have these interesting bluffs that you can climb to the top of and get these remarkable overlooks, often of the Mississippi River. We have parks that feature waterfalls that are absolutely stunning, and we kind of get into the different kinds of waterfalls we get, the really tall, skinny ones, the short, wide ones that you can walk right up to. We have parks that are along what we call the Fresh Coast. That's like Michigan. So we get to see these like massive sweeping views and these picturesque beaches. But then we also have a section we call Lakes That Are Still Pretty Great, which is all about our inland lakes. And then, of course, there's rivers, there's woodsy parks, and we also have a section all about the parks that are for the history books, the ones that feature a lot of our state heritage and where we came from before.
So many great things and, you know, lots to choose from with 50, right? But I want to start with what's close to home, which you categorize as just within 1 hour's drive of Milwaukee, which is great. And let's start with Harrington Beach. And I will say I went there a ton during COVID, even if it was just for a little day walk.
Well, that's a great thing is anyone who lives in the state of Wisconsin is probably pretty close to at least one state park that they can get to. More likely, they're close to a few. And so Harrington Beach is this great state park. It's on the sandy stretch of Lake Michigan, but it also has this really unique history to it. It preserves this old historic Wisconsin quarry town. So there's this big, like crystal clear quarry lake that you can walk around and you can peer into this 45-foot pit because the water is so clear and get a good look at it.
Yeah, and lots of good camping sites as well that are kind of more in the prairie land if you want it, or you can hear the lake even too. So Harrington's a great place to start. And if people want to take a trip just a bit further up 43 North, there's Kohler Andre State Park.
Kohler Andre is fantastic. It's actually my most recent state park, the newest one that I've seen. I visited it while I was writing this package. And what's so cool about it is it's actually two parks, kind of for the price of one. The park combines Terry Andre and John Michael Kohler State Park. And the big draw to this park is that it has a cord walk, which is a lot like a boardwalk, except instead of walking over water, you're walking over sand. And you get to see these really delicate sand dunes and how beautiful they are. The last time I was there, I saw sandhill cranes, but a lot of people get really excited because they get to see deer prancing around the dunes.
Certainly a very picturesque park. Up next for within an hour of Milwaukee is Aztalan State Park.
Aztalan it's a super important archaeological site for the state of Wisconsin. It preserves this ancient late woodland Native American village that was around roughly between the 11th and 13th centuries. So that is just super old. In 1919, they did this massive excavation of the area and uncovered a lot of the original settlement. So when you're there, you go into the visitor center and you can get this trail guide that will show you the history of this park, and you can walk around and do your own little self-guided tour, which is very cool.
I mean, there's so much history in a lot of the parks that you wrote about. It's something I hadn't considered and reasons to pick a new park, but I love that. And we're going to go outside of our little hour outside of Milwaukee path here, and we're going to go over a few of what are off the beaten path. And since COVID, camping obviously has gotten very popular, even into what we typically see as the off season. But you spoke with an expert to find some lesser known features, right?
Yeah, so I love our off the beaten path section, because what it does is it takes our three most popular state parks, Devil's Lake State Park, Peninsula State Park, and Governor Dodge State Park. Those are the parks that draw the most visitors. And we talked to an expert within the Wisconsin DNR, Sarah Bernaski, and I asked her, if you're going to these big parks and you want to kind of skirt the crowds, where should you go? And she gave us some great advice. So for Devil's Lake State Park, she talks about the fact that they just added a new trail there that is still a little lesser known that you can hit. At Peninsula State Park, she talks about the fact that they do these great theater shows within the park where you can go and catch a show. And these shows usually are about local connections. One of them is called The Fisherman's Daughter. And that one tells the story of two sisters in early Fish Creek who are dealing with what happens when the land that they live on gets turned into Peninsula State Park. And then Governor Dodge State Park, she offers up this great trail that actually leads you to a cave. And she makes a point to recommend that you should bring your flashlight so that you can see inside.
Yeah, a cave exploration sounds like a ton of fun and something different to do while you're hiking. And let's go to the Chain of Lakes area of Waupaca, Wisconsin, to Hartman Creek State Park next.
Yes, I remember the first time I went to Hartman Creek State Park. I had no idea what I was stepping into, and it has since become one of my absolute favorites. What it is it's part of the Chain of Lakes, which means these lakes, which are all spring-fed, are all interconnected. And so what you can do is you can rent a kayak, or you can bring your own, or a paddleboard, or a canoe, or whatever suits you. And you can basically do a little paddle trail through these different springs. And the real finale is if you end at Marl Lake. This lake is an unbelievably, like almost surreal, crystal clear blue lake that when you see it, you'll realize how spectacular it is. And so after you've worked up your sweat from paddling, you can jump in and take a dip, and you'll see tons of people just floating in their life preservers or swimming free and having a ton of fun taking a break from their boating.
I love the picture that you put there in my head. So we've been talking about a number of different state parks, but I want to give some love and a shout out to our first state park ever, and it's called Interstate Park. Can you share a bit more about the history there?
This was a really fun surprise to learn when I was writing about the state park feature, because the first thing that I thought to myself was, why do we have a state park system? Why is it so big? How did we get so much of this land protected? And one thing that I learned in the process is that Wisconsin was one of the very first states to even consider a setup like this. We started talking about the Wisconsin state park system really early on. In 1878, the Wisconsin legislature approved the protection of what was then called the state park, one of the first of its kind in the country. But it wasn't until 1900 that that really came to fruition. And the state park would eventually become Interstate State Park. And that also led to the founding of our Wisconsin state park system, which is such an incredible undertaking. We have so much protected land in our state.
That is really amazing and something we take for granted in our own backyard. And hopefully with this guide, it's a good starting point for people to get out, whether they're regular campers or just want to find something new in a day trip. But I want to end our conversation with one of your all-time favorite state parks, which is Rock Island. So why is this one of your tried and trues?
Rock Island State Park is just, it's like nothing you've ever done. So you go, everyone knows about Door County. People go to Peninsula State Park. But if you drive all the way to the tip of Door County, you have to go past that really famous curved road. You'll get to a dock and you'll have to take a car ferry over to Washington Island, which is another really beautiful island. If you go there, you should stop at the Lavender Fields. But you take your car, you go to another pier and you ditch your car and you get on a person ferry and you head to Rock Island State Park. Once you get to that island, there are no cars there. It's just people. You have to walk everywhere you go. You're likely going to camp there, but it's quiet like you've never heard, because when are you anywhere where there are no cars? And it's just super beautiful and spectacular. You can hike the whole park in a day, but it still feels remarkably big, but you get to experience the whole thing very well. It's a wonderful park. I highly recommend it.
I'll have to add that to my list. Well, Allie, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about some of the gems in our state park system.
All right. Thank you for having me, Audrey. It was great talking about them.
Allie Waters is a freelance writer, and we spoke last summer. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then return with singer-songwriter and guitarist Craig Finn for our latest Live at Lake Effect. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring local and nationally touring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, Wisconsin. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase musicians once a month through an interview with the band exclusively on Lake Effect, plus film performances. This episode features singer, songwriter, and guitarist Craig Finn, who you may know best as the singer of The Hold Steady. Today, he's joining us in the surf shop to share songs from his recent solo record, Always Been. Here's Craig introducing the first track of the album.
Hey, I'm Craig Finn. This is my friend Nelson Devereaux, and this is the first song on my new album. My album's called Always Been, and this song is called Bethany. It goes like this. In the later afternoon, it sort of softens on the avenue, wasting the remainder of the day, drinking off what's left of the glasses on the table, when the couples get their checks and walk away. And I'll be here tomorrow, and then every day that follows, till I see you later on this week. Will you come and pick me up when I get up off the bus? Will you help me bring my stuff out to the beach? When we met, I was the reverend. You were in the congregation. Didn't happen right away, but pretty soon. And I never had a calling. I just had a strong desire to be the one that stood up in this room. When I was a child, I used to fixate on the chaplain, the way he brought the widows all to tears. That looked like a decent way to make a little living here. Gave myself to God for a few years. I built a chapel off the exit on the highway outside Harrisburg. There was all that new development back then. Parishioners would come to me with cakes and little pastries and asked me for my blessing once again. But I couldn't shake the feeling I was faking all the faithfulness, and every single sermon was a fraud. I drifted through the rituals, prideful, high and pitiful, pissing off a petty, vengeful God. Pissing off a petty, vengeful God. Parents are both ancient now. I'm staying at their summer house. Clear out on the weekends when they come. To my sisters with their daughter on the fringe of Philadelphia, with their skinny cigarettes and snapping gum. But I'm grateful for the place to stay. I'm caddying on Saturdays. The money's not as good as it was when we were teenagers. Walk back from the golf course, cut through a couple backyards, but I try to keep my eyes pointed heavenward. In another prior life, the reverend and his wife were sitting in the kitchen making plans, unaware of all the mess the pressure in the flesh is capable of making in a man. And I never really fell
because I was never quite convinced. But I must admit I miss all the simplicity of a woman and a man. Though I also understand the reasons you no longer want to be with me. Now I can see why you no longer want to be with me. Devil came in hot. Someone called the cops. I explained to them how much it is you mean to me. The cuffs, they made a click as they wrapped around my wrists. Everybody's got some version of security. Somewhere there's a life where the reverend has his wife. Jesus has his ministry in Galilee. But the sunset looks like blood from the windows of this bus. Somewhere between Harrisburg and Bethany. Somewhere between Harrisburg and Bethany. Somewhere between Harrisburg and Bethany.
Hi, this is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with Milwaukee musician and Live at Lake Effect co-producer Trapper Shep. Hey, Trapper.
Hey, Audrey. It feels so right today to have Craig Finn here in this Midwestern surf shop, a singer-songwriter whose roots are in the Midwest, but is taking a California twist with his new album. So let's start by talking about that, Craig. Can you tell listeners where you're originally from and how that shaped the identity of you and your band, The Hold Steady?
Yeah, I'm originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I've lived in New York City for 25 years since the year 2000. But I grew up in Minneapolis and very much consider myself a Minnesotan. I think one of the main ways that it influenced me musically growing up in Minneapolis was I was well-timed for a great part of the Minneapolis music scene, and the first bands I went to go see were The Replacements, Husker Du, Soul Asylum, and those three bands especially made me want to be in a band and also kind of formed like my sonic identity of what I think a great rock and roll band should sound like. I'm currently on tour with Bob Mould, who was the guitar player and singer in Husker Du, so lately, it's been a real full circle moment that I've been really in touch with. But I think that Minneapolis scene, both the music and sort of the ideals of doing things honestly and doing things yourself have been something I've tried to bring with me.
And as people will have heard with the song we just played and the videos with all three of the songs you shared with us in the shop, your new album, Always Been, takes a bit of a different tone compared to some of the louder instrumentalists you were inspired by and grew up with. The album was produced by Adam of The War on Drugs. And compared to your last solo albums, can you talk a bit about the approach you took with this one and how you wanted it to sound different or any fun challenges you wanted to give yourself?
Yeah, so this record, Always Been, I kind of felt like it was time to make a change in the producer chair, if only because I'd made, between The Hold Steady and my solo work, I'd made 7 albums in a row with the same producer, Josh Kaufman. And I thought, I love Josh, and I'm really proud of the work we'd done together, but I thought it's time for maybe to do something different. I asked my friend Adam Grandeseal from The War on Drugs if he wanted to produce it. He had apparently produced one band a while back, but to my knowledge, he hadn't produced anyone, and I thought it might be interesting. Adam goes on this like sonic journey when he writes. He kind of a journey of sound. He keeps recording music and adding to it and taking it away. Eventually, he'll get to like writing lyrics pretty late, as I'm told, later in the process. And I'm the exact opposite. I have like 1 or 2 chords and 3 pages of lyrics. So I thought, maybe we'll meet in the middle as an interesting experiment. And I'd always wanted to make a record in Los Angeles. Some of the press around this record said like it's kind of an LA record in sound. It's funny because once I got out there, I realized like studios notoriously don't have many windows. So I don't know how much of an LA record you can make while you're working. But the drive to and from certainly was very LA. And it ended up being a different sound. I think Adam brought a lot of the sonics to it. It remained a direct record, but Adam really helped me work on the sonics of it all to create something that sounded new compared to my other records.
Speaking of LA, the album cover of Always Been may look familiar to some, as it's the same freeway that Randy Newman stood on for his album Little Criminals, and it features you in the dapper suit that you're wearing today. Yeah. So you can check that out in the videos on our YouTube. But can you talk about how songwriters like him inspired this album?
Yeah. One of the first things that Adam Grandisseal and I really bonded over was Warren Zevon. In fact, the first time I ever got on stage with The War on Drugs, we did a cover of Accidentally Like a Martyr by Warren Zevon. And we sort of talked about that sensibility, that kind of California songwriter sensibility. People like Randy Newman, Warren Zevon, Jackson Browne, even, I guess, in some sense, Tom Petty has some L.A. vibes. And the directness I was talking about, I think about Petty a lot. But I think that those, you know, Zevon, Petty, Newman, was something aesthetically that we could hear. And some of the use of piano, for instance, or I don't know, some of the vibes. And one of the things that I love about all those songwriters is they're sometimes, not always, but sometimes funny. And I like that in songs. And one of the challenges I made for this record was to have at least one line in every song that I thought was funny. So it's lost on me whether everyone will find it funny, but I wanted, and I definitely felt like I succeeded in one line that made me smile every time I sang it.
Can we give listeners a preview of that line to
listen
for?
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on what song, but let's see. On the first song, on Bethany, I thought it was funny when he says that he's caddying, but the money's not as good as it was when they were teenagers. I thought that was funny to me.
And as you introed these three songs, there was the common thread. You're like, oh, it's about the same person. So the narrative running through Always Been is about a priest who's struggling with his faith. How did this inform the rest of the record? What's kind of the through line? What inspired you to latch onto a central character?
So I wrote the first song on the record, Bethany, which I played first here. It was the first song I wrote for this record. It's the first song we recorded. It was the first song I saw. Showed Adam when I started showing him songs. And we put it first on the record for very much a reason. It introduces a character, this priest, that became a priest without believing in God. And because of that, things kind of came crashing down. And after having some success, he lost it all. And that song finds him wandering the Delaware shore trying to figure out what's next and what went wrong, etc. And I got really interested in that character. I thought he was very rich for a couple reasons. One is that I think anyone who stands up and, you know, wants to profess or interpret the divine for humans, it's an interesting place to be and a challenge in itself. So I thought there was a lot of material there. And I also don't think it's lost on me that, you know, a rock and roll singer is also someone who gets up and tries to build community and maybe professes some ideas in the way that a religious leader might. So I was really interested in that. And what I found is, like, after I finished that song, I wanted to write more and more about the same person. I just kind of kept taking different angles on him. And most of the songs on the record end up being about that guy and that story.
Yeah, your concerts are always this really beautiful, cathartic, and I think for a lot of fans, almost a spiritual experience. I've been to some shows of yours in Milwaukee. New Year's Eve in Milwaukee particular was a memorable one, but can you talk about some of your history with this city and what stands out?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of history. The whole steady is a ton of history, especially with this city. Galen Palivka, our bass player, grew up in Whitefish Bay and went to school there. Our original drummer, Judd Council, was his classmate, or I don't know if they were classmates, but they were both went to the same high school. Tad Kubler, our guitar player, is from Janesville, Wisconsin. So we kind of have a split between Wisconsin and Minnesota in the band. We've played memorable concerts everywhere here. You know, the one at the Riverside at New Year's Eve was a real memorable one. But we've played all the way going back to Anopa Brewery, I think, was some of our early ones, and multiple Summerfests. It's always a big tour stop. I mean, even I think maybe the most fun was when we first started and we'd come here and we'd stay with Galen's mom, Faye Palivka, and we always had big, big nights hanging out. And she lived not too far from the Landmark Lanes, so we were in there on some big nights.
from Landmark to Lake Effect. Yeah, thanks for being here today, Craig. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Craig Find, accompanied by Milwaukee native Nelson Devereaux on the tenor saxophone, clarinet, and synth. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to watch him perform three original songs from his latest album, Always Been, in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy, and thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. WUWM's YouTube page has our past episodes of Live at Lake Effect featuring David Shaw, Sullis, Buffalo Nichols, and much more.
Sorry that I wasn't in touch since. Spent way too much time on people without any substance. And I decided that I'm gonna push forward. I'm committed to making the change. But you gotta remember I never go out in the rain.
And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about Employee Milwaukee and their work to develop workforce solutions and connect job seekers with opportunities. Plus, in Books and Beyond, we'll learn about the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.